Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming today. I'm Robert Sweeney, a painter and chair of the Department of Art and the History of Art. It is my great honor to welcome Frank Stella to Amherst College. We are privileged to have four of Mr. Stella's works in our collection here at the Meade Museum. There will be a reception on Frank Stella's honor in the museum immediately following the talk. Frank Stella has been a central figure in the contemporary art dialogue over the last five decades. He was born in Malden, Massachusetts, and attended Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, where he studied painting with Patrick Morgan. Upon graduation, he entered Princeton, where he continued painting and majored in history. Numerous visits to galleries in New York City were also a critical part of his education. Frank Stella moved to New York City after his graduation from Princeton in 1958. He rented a storefront on Manhattan's Lower East Side and began making paintings by penciling lines on raw canvases, partially filling in the open spaces with black house paint. The process left stripes that appeared to have uncertain parameters between the penciled lines. He eliminated illusionistic space in order to focus on the physicality of the flat surface. This body of work, known as the Black Paintings, became a milestone in the development of the 1960s minimalist movement. In 1959, several of his paintings were included in Three Young Americans at the Allen Memorial Art Museum at Oberlin, as well as in 16 Americans at the MoMA. Frank Stella also joined the legendary Leo Castelli Gallery in 1959. The black paintings evolved into the aluminum painting series of 1960 and the copper painting series of 1960 through 61. A radical shift came in 66-67 with his irregular polygon series, which employed interlocking geometric shapes bordered by bands, creating large central fields of color. The protractor series of 67 through 71 combined monumental scale, intense color juxtapositions, and for the first time, curvilinear forms. Frank Stella began his extended engagement with printmaking in the mid-60s, working first with master printer Kenneth Tyler. In 1967, Mr. Stella designed the set and costumes for Scramble, a dance piece by Mercy Cunningham. The Museum of Modern Art also presented a retrospective of Frank Stella's work in 1970, the youngest artist who ever had one at the museum. In the 70s, Frank Stella introduced relief into his art, referring to it as maximalist painting for its sculptural qualities. Frank Stella challenged the categories of painting and sculpture by creating hybrids of them both. He experimented with non-traditional materials like fabrics, plastics, and painted constructions that employed physical space instead of its illusion. The Polish Village series of 70 through 73 was the first in a series of large wall-hung color relief constructions. It was also during this period that he participated in the art strike against war, repression, and racism, which aggressively challenged the political status quo. Mr. Stella's pieces during the 70s and 80s became more elaborate and, in his words, baroque in their development of curvilinear forms, vibrant color, and aggressive brushstrokes. An important experience for Frank Stella was his residency at the American Academy in Rome in 1982 through 83, where he studied and was inspired by the work of Caravaggio, Rubens, Rembrandt, and Velázquez, among others. In 1983, Harvard University named Frank Stella the Charles Elliott Norton Professor of Poetry, an honor previously bestowed on Igor Stravinsky. At Harvard, he delivered six lectures, which were later published under the title Working Space, or acknowledging its double entendre, Working Space. Here, Frank Stella presents a rich discussion of the particular space employed by Caravaggio and Rubens, which animated painting and allowed it to breathe. He calls for the rejuvenation of abstraction by achieving the pictorial depth of these artists. He concludes the lecture series by saying, quote, "Abstraction has the freedom to be large without magnification, the ability to be small without miniaturization. In a sense, abstraction gains its freedom, its unfettered expandability, its own working space by eluding the spatial dictates of the real and the ideal image." clearly abstraction today works to make its own space, unquote. His work continued to evolve using a wide range of materials and fabrication techniques and ultimately became fully three-dimensional by the 90s. He began making freestanding sculptures for public spaces and developing architectural projects. In 1992 through 93, for example, he created the entire decorative scheme for Toronto's Princess of Wales Theatre, which includes a 10,000-square-foot mural. He created an aluminum band shell inspired by a folding hat from Brazil, which was built in downtown Miami in 1999. In 2001, a monumental Frank Stella sculpture was installed outside the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. He continues pushing his vision, making and exhibiting his art internationally. He is currently an active member of the Artists' Rights Society, which defends artists' copyrights. Frank Stella's work is represented internationally in major public and private collections, and he has been the subject of important retrospective exhibitions in the United States, Europe, and Japan. As an artist, an intellectual, and a humanist, Frank Stella has had and continues to have a broad and deep impact on how we define ourselves in the contemporary world. He has accomplished this through his own invention and reinvention. It's with the greatest pleasure that I present to you Frank Stella.
Sort of like a fantastic paid political announcement. But anyway, the talk I'm going to give today is a talk that I gave 2 years ago, in May, I don't know what the day today is actually, but this was given in Jena on May 23rd, 2006. And I delivered it there at the invitation of Professor Franz Joachim Verspol. And he died recently, actually 3 months ago, and I have the feeling, my feelings about him are so strong, that I really feel that I wanted to do something, and this lecture, for better or for worse, is what I have to say to him again. And usually I would jump right into it, but I'm going to, if there's any chalk on the blackboard, I'll just write down a few things if there is. Just to make it easier, the university is Jena, and according to Google, the University of Jena was founded in the year 1558, and is one of the oldest universities in Germany. Jena is a pleasant city, small city, about 100 kilometers west of Dresden and 250 kilometers south of Berlin, and is a world-renowned center of excellence for optics, being home to ... or more. But what they're talking about is Carl Zeiss optics, and which is today called Jena optics. And it figures somewhat into the talk. And Jena started in 1558, but we're concerned with 1993. And that's, I'm not sure exactly when that is, but it's very close to the fall of the GDR. Because in that year, Franz first call. Was made professor at Jena, and his idea was to restart and redo the art history seminar, as they called it, or the art history department. And the reason it was being redone is that it was the end of the former art history department, the GDR, Socialist Art History, and there was a change to Western art history. Now, there might even be some people left who think that maybe that wasn't such a great idea. And it has a little bit of an edge to it in some way, although it's all really over by now. But Jena, being a great university, with Fichte, Hegel, Schiller, but Karl Marx actually attended Jena for a while and then went on to do other things. So the change from the socialist art history to the traditional Western art history is somehow appropriate. So, and the last thing is that name you might not know, Emil Knurbel. Probably a mark in here somewhere. He's a German abstract painter, a little bit younger than I am, I guess, and quite well known. He recently showed with Mary Boom and has a gallery in New York and has a very big piece of a very large exhibition in the Dia Foundation in Beacon, New York, that Cathedral of Minimalism. And I think that's all you really need to know. So, I can. Just one other point. It was Professor Firstball who invited me to Jena a little bit after 1993, and I was given a doctorate there. And so I was returning to Jena to give this talk for a doctorate that was to introduce Emil Knurbel. I am very happy to return to Jena to help the university and its community celebrate the achievement of Emil Knurbel. For me, Emil Knurbel is a very special artist. He is a very compelling and successful abstract artist. Of course, it's not surprising that I would admire an abstract artist. I have happily devoted my working life to the pursuit of abstract art. But I don't think of Emil Knurbel as an abstract artist. I think of him as an immensely refreshing artist. He brings vivid color and clear form to our eyes. In our hysterical, muddied art world, his work is a beacon of delight, a calm surface of absolute aesthetic pleasure. I know that the comparisons of artists of our time with the artists of the past are very suspect. If not in the eyes of the art public, then surely in the eyes of the art historians. Nonetheless, Emi's freshness and clarity bring to my mind the glory of Annibale Carracci's Farnese Ceiling. There, color and form are linked together, creating a pictorial space that sets the stage for a luminous and magical experience. The result is a feeling of openness, where in the canopy above us, color and form and articulated space coalesce into a wonderful spectacle. We see a transparent yet active film of optical energy enveloping the imagery drawn from Annibale's hand. It would be nice to pursue the relationship between Annibale and Emi in greater detail, but that is not today's assigned task, and in a university setting, it is only proper that I take my assignment seriously. As you all undoubtedly know, I am speaking here today at the invitation of Professor Firstball. He has indicated, or perhaps more accurately, dictated the subject of my address. Here's part of the telephone transcript of our conversation. Professor Firstball began, "For your 70th birthday, you might want to talk about art and science in Jena." I thought to myself, "Are you crazy?" And then I answered, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You might want to talk about the relationship of art and science in a university setting." I said, "I don't know anything about universities, let alone university settings. Furthermore, it's obvious I don't know anything about science. My sons are still laughing at my notion of fractional dimensions." And later, when I was overcome with another bright idea that perhaps numbers could see, they just rolled their eyes and said, "Give it up, Dad." Moreover, I continued to Firstball, "When it comes to art, I don't fare much better. All I know is that I try to make it. But honestly, what could I tell you that I know, or have even learned after having spent 50 years trying to make art?" With that outburst, I thought I had said a lot, enough perhaps to make Professor Firstball leave me alone. Undeterred, however, Professor Firstball replied, "That's not what they want to hear. they want to know about the relationship of art and science, especially at the university level. Under pressure, I guess, I regressed. I began to react as most students do. Having told the professor what I sincerely thought and having articulated to myself at least the pointlessness of the assigned task, I became resigned to the task. It is possible to talk about art and science, I suppose, in a way that talking about anything is possible. Talking about art and science in a way that is worthwhile is another matter. For me, thinking about art and science begins with a barrage of questions, each one of which is a nightmare in its own right. If we want to talk about art and science, we have to ask, what can we talk about? What do we take science to mean? What do we really think art is? I can only offer some obvious answers. We hope science is knowledge, and most of us believe art is beauty. But notice at the beginning of our discussion, we are already doubly bound. We are stuck in a quagmire of hope and belief, trying in some way to define knowledge and recognize beauty. Perhaps the only way out is to be confrontational, admittedly an anathema in the university, but necessary here to address a topic that already appears too difficult and too perverse. Can I ask if this discussion is really about something else? Could it be that the interest in the relationship between art and science is really about the university's vision of itself? In other words, is the whole question about science and art simply a smokescreen to mask the university's worry about the efficacy of teaching art in an educational setting? I believe the university really believes it knows about science, the pursuit of knowledge, but it questions if it does or even should know about beauty, the pursuit of art. It appears that the university would be more content if it were able to limit the study of art and teaching of art making to a time past, containing it in a suitable historical framework. This mode of thought, this attempt to engender a stable and sensible curriculum, clearly reveals the fear of the art of one's own time. Art history gets into trouble in the university setting when it approaches the study of contemporary art. Contemporary art, by definition, is a questionable pursuit given university standards. It doesn't yield much useful knowledge, and its content, its supposed beauty, provokes many endless and fruitless arguments. Finally, from the university's point of view, the teaching of art making is just as compromised as art history is when it has to deal with today's be-with-it pressures. The most common put-down of university studio art programs is that they are academic. But surely this remark comes as no surprise. It must be easier to teach someone how to attempt to copy the art of the past than to teach them how to paint or make art effectively in the ever-changing, ever-fleeting present, what I guess the physical scientists might call the here and now. As it stands now, the division, the gap between art and science is unbridgeable. Cliched as it may be, it appears safe to say that art and science are ships passing in the night. Science dominates the university curriculum, while art is tolerated as an addendum. In some hard-hearted sense, we all believe that science can justify itself and its worth. We know the scientific method has withstood many assaults, some patently foolish and some patently dangerous. In the end, its method, supported by the proof of reproducibility, has a force that art cannot match. In its place, art can only offer a sense of accomplishment, a worthwhile uniqueness drawn from consensus-approved examples of great art of the past, and hopefully, to keep our attention, some consensus-approved examples of great art of the more recent past. Trying to shake an appearance of desperation when compared with science, art seeks validation in its uniqueness, a moment of apprehended beauty that is not reproducible. This approval by consensus of the beauty and uniqueness of art eludes any convincing proof. Art is somehow too circumscribed, too self-referential, and finally, in many annoying ways, simply too amorphous to withstand investigation. As the source of society's educational system, the university is understandably withholding and justifiably cautious in its approach to art. The university cannot help but recognize the primacy of science. Science is seen as the way to knowledge, and knowledge in turn is seen as the road to progress, power, and self-preservation. So why bother with art when beauty, even if it can be grasped, has little ability to compete with the power of science? Although art appears as a failure in a strict university contest, it does survive. I suggest it survives for at least two reasons. Art meets the test of thought, and art successfully engages the test of emotional appeal. The test of thought asks whether art can sustain a line of legitimate intellectual inquiry. The test of emotional appeal asks whether people really like art and whether they are able to appreciate it in a science-dominated university atmosphere. Even though science is the darling of university governors, the range of its emotional appeal is still exceptionally narrow. Perhaps art's greater emotional pull explains why scientists are so easily drawn to the romance of creativity. Science are quick to respond to a notion of beauty they see in the actions of nature. They seem taken with an idea my father expressed to me as simple elegance, the beauty of a straightforward equation, which explains a lot. We see it today taken to what seems to be an extreme, certainly an expensive extreme. The search for an elegant equation that will explain everything that is, about the physical world. Fortunately, above the mini world of particle physics and its arcane mathematical expressions of string theory, there are scientific observations of nature which reveal more manageable ideas of beauty, especially beauty at work. The study of a complex system, say for example that of fluid motion, which is beautiful in itself, reveals recognizable patterns, again beautiful in themselves. This layered process of investigation shows us how science in its search for understanding is driven by a reflex reaction to find beauty along the way. Now art, man-made beauty, which at its highest level successfully competes with natural beauty, clearly attracts the interest of science. It is often said that art is produced by creative activity, an activity hard to describe and hard to analyze in any rigorous way. But rather than being put off by such a difficulty, in a nod towards beauty, science willingly embraces it to make room in its arena for creative activity. Apparently, science recognizes and appreciates something of itself in the work and workings of art. What would seem more true of art than of science? The accommodation of intuition, irrational thought, and undisciplined activity is actually prized as well by science, no doubt because many important scientific discoveries seemed indebted to institution and chance as much as to reason and purposeful effort. Many a smart scientist feels he might go a long way with a little artistic gift, a little aesthetic insight. But really, is the university going to teach science as an interactive beauty and knowledge class? Is the university ready for intuitive and chance-driven research coupled with irrational and purposeless activity? Pub Life 101, if you will. By and large, the university doesn't wish to give in to the seduction of science by the romance of creativity. In self-defense, it routinely segregates art and science and favors science over art. The university feels it can afford a token gesture towards the creative spark, but it wants to make sure that nothing catches fire. In the end, the university expresses its bias quite clearly by sending creative students away to art school. By suggesting that creative art belongs somewhere else, The university makes a clear choice for knowledge over beauty, for science over art. In spite of the bias, which I have to admit I find very understandable, I believe art can pass the test of thought as it passes the test of emotional appeal and thus qualify for curriculum status. I believe art is a legitimate form of intellectual inquiry that can sustain itself at a rewarding and fruitful level. True, art can only survive, not prove itself. Nonetheless, it can ask worthwhile questions and investigate serious problems raised by its observations of nature and the nature of self, which it sees as part of nature. Art has been successful in observing nature and itself. It has convinced us of its ability to express its exploratory instincts, its investigative bent, in compelling visual and tactile forms. I suggest here that beauty, the end product of successful art, however much we might want to argue about proving its existence or defining it, makes us, by its mere apprehension, think. Now surely this is no mean feat for art. Establishing the idea that in the university, the wonder of beauty can give impetus to thought. Still, science is greater than art. Science has no causal connection to art. Art and science don't mix. This must be true, then, the end of First Bowles' assignment, the end of the affair between art and science, except for the example of one man, Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo made the confounding of knowledge and beauty available to all. Leonardo is the source of the romance of creativity, of the dream that art and science go hand in hand. Is Leonardo, then, the hope and or the proof that the university can have it both ways, unassailable knowledge and inarguable beauty? Here we come close to what the university may really want, universality. It wants what Leonardo found to be such an easy thing to do, to become universal and so substantiate its name. Facil cosa e facile universale. Yes, easy for Leonardo, but what about me? What about you? And what about all the rest of us? Is he the or a universal man? Or is he just an anomaly who in a freakish way represents uniqueness on such a grand scale that we call it absolute beauty? Does this knowledge, dare I say it, Leonardo's unique fusion of art and science make the pursuit of knowledge, dare I say it, trivial, and by extension the pursuit of a theory of everything, might not be worth it? Probably not. However, on the level of art, for art, not science, I propose that Leonardo's universality is a suitable substitute theory of everything. He was art and science. He is still beauty and knowledge. Leonardo's universality, what Valéry called his symbolic mind, remains at large. But in our time, an imbalance reigns. Equilibrium is denied as beauty is trivialized and knowledge is immensified. Science grows as if reproducibility begat reproduction. Art stagnates as if its uniqueness has sterilized beauty. In the end, it is obvious that the most art can do is hope to sustain itself, while science continues to engorge itself on the extended natural world, and perhaps even on human consciousness itself. Thank you.
Science and art may be more like each other than we think. And the reason I say that is both of them about, in a way, about creation, developing new ideas and new ways to look at things. So, of course, there's the static phenomenon. If you have the science appears to have more rules, but art has some rules. And
No, an artist that will admit that there are any rules.
Right. No, but I mean, I think, I'm not saying,
okay,
there's always
some
rules. Yeah. So, but a scientist, an artist, builds upon, you know, as they go on their own career and using knowledge of other people's works. And what the scientist, an artist does, excuse me, is to create a new way of looking at things. And I think a successful scientist is not a person who looks at things statically, but has to think of things in a new way. And I think art, in a way, teaches that, the same way that science does. Because it's really not about the ideas you have. It's how to look at things differently to be successful in either one.
Yeah, I'm not going to, I mean, I agree. But the problem really is, it doesn't matter how you do it, one way or the other, how you make science or how you make art. But there is still, for art, the test of reproducibility, and there's nothing, and not did I say that, for science. And for art, we just don't have anything remotely as effective or as convincing of that. I mean, Bernoulli's principle works when you get on the airplane, or you hope it does. But one of the other things I just wanted to mention in this talk being about art and science, which is relevant to the situation of the university. I talk a lot about the university here, and it applies, I think, in general, to universities in general. But it was a real issue at the time in Jena, because with the changeover from the GDR, it was true in every discipline, and particularly science under the GDR was science but technology. So there was there was a lot of pressure on the university to find its way. And it's not hard to imagine in Germany that they wanted to avoid frivolity and wasting money and all kinds of things in the rebuilding. So art had to prove itself with a little more force.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question about the definition of beauty. I had opportunity some years ago to be with scientists who would look at a formula. When they finally got to the formula they were looking for, and they would say, "This one is beautiful." So I don't know if from that point of view there is any way to compare art and science. I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
Right. I agree with you 100%, but it's still a problem. That beauty that they see, they can recognize it as beauty, but they have to take the beauty that they see one step beyond that and put it to use and then test it to another function. If we look through the microscope and see something beautifully, we can steal it and then paste it on a piece of paper and say, "See how beautiful that is? That's art." And then it becomes, it could be good or it could be bad. But it's unique then, actually, even though we've reproduced it from real life, because it has no connection to anything. It's isolated, it's taken away, and it's presented only as art, which is one of the problems. Yes. Okay. I'll come back. Okay. Up here. Yeah. That's it.
I find it really interesting that this university, which is so entrenched in this, Jena is where the Carl Zeiss Optics Center is. That's totally interesting that they would have invited you as a visual artist to visit there. I mean, it says something about the relationship between art and technology. I mean, particularly with Carl Zeiss, he makes lenses, and that is so definitely related to the world of art. I mean, so many artists take pictures with Zeiss lenses.
It's true. I mean, but you know, Germany's a really problematic place. It always was and probably always will be. And so these things are magnified, certainly the business of science and technology. And I mean, you know, Hegel, I mean, and the tradition of humanism runs very deep. What we know of, a lot of the past and a lot of the Greek and Roman world and just so many things, and certainly art history is a totally German until the war, when it was all transplanted more or less to America and England, a German phenomenon.
I'm on the physics faculty here, and I regularly teach with an art historian, a friend of Bob's. These two worlds, for the last 20 years, have intersected in this room and in other places on this campus. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to modify your division between science and the arts to be one where, I'm thinking of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who said it's possible to distinguish without dividing. We can distinguish the arts from the sciences.
You know, I'm willing to accept that. But
let me make one more caveat then. If you ask, you know, what is it that a teacher of the sciences shoots for, what is it that a researcher strives for, it is that unique moment that you described in the arts. It's very easy to write a formula on the blackboard. It's very easy to show a slide of Frank Stella's work. It's a very different thing to get a student, or even yourself, to the point where you actually see the work of art, or that equation, as the discoverer or the painter saw it in the moment that they created it.
I agree with that almost 100%, but there's a huge difference in the fact that after you have the idea and something, you can give it to somebody else, your formula, if it works. I can't give the black paintings to anybody else, or even to myself.
Well, I don't know whether to challenge you a little on that.
No, go ahead. You can. I'm willing.
There are probably more papers written about your work than are written about mine.
And I'm sure that that's part of the problem. I mean,
your paintings probably sell for more than my papers sell for.
Well, they did.
Which is to say that there's a certain kind of recognition which thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have accredited to your work. Now, are they going to replicate your work? Probably there are many who have tried.
Yeah, but you're confounding entertainment with reality. What we do are on that level, but I'm trying to keep to the work, I mean, and to the, you know, to what people really do and its real consequences. I mean, the other things, they may happen, but they're not essential to the funding, in my opinion. Okay.
Well, it seems that art's value is so often measured by only its end product, while the entire scientific process is seen as valuable, and I'm just wondering if you think that more importance needs to be placed on the investigative process, the creative process that happens leading up to the creation of an end product, than as opposed to only, like you said, like you can't give away your black.
You know, it sounds like a good point, but the problem with it is that all of it, it really, as far as art, and probably we were saying it before, in the what leads up to it and how it happens and everything, there really are a lot of paths to that end point. But one of the real problems is knowing when you get there. And when you get there, for art, it's just you got there, that it's over. It's like not going to do anybody else any great good, except maybe on the level of entertainment, or maybe on the level of following it back and thinking about why it reaches a point where it does seem unique and what, you know, at what level, how much art is it in the art? But all of those arguments, once you get into the art, and then you have to value and grade the art, you're in trouble because it's relative. And it started that way, and it's going to end that way. But, as I said in the discussion, the only way that art reaches a level or we're able to deal with is through consensus. And that consensus only exists, again, defined by us in our time. We have that consensus, and we accept the art that's out there in terms of that consensus. But that's what we're given, and that's what we go by. But in fact, I don't think it has much effect. I mean, it has an effect on the outward situation. I don't think it has much effect, unfortunately, on the people who have to make art. They're stuck. It's not going to really help them. Okay, we can go. Okay.
Just before we go, Just to change the pace a little bit, your art has gone in many different directions, and I wonder if you could just spend a few minutes on what you're working on now.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to ask why I was such a scatterbrain. I'm working on making three-dimensional objects that are supposed to be art objects, and almost 90% of it is involved with rapid prototyping, which everyone here will be familiar with. All model building, three-dimensional model building, which started, I first came across it many years ago in the perfume industry, making bottles. That's what I'm doing. I'm making sculpture that's complicated enough so that if you push two objects together, you can reproduce it by essentially taking whatever you have, whatever objects you have on the computer. If you scan them, they're transparent, and you can push them together. And then you can scan them again, cut them in slices like a CAT scan. And once you have that, you can build anything, or you can build any object like that. Except you can only really build it in polymers or in metal on a small scale. It would be good if you could, if you want a technological problem, if you could figure out how to weld on that with that kind of system, you'd really be in heaven. Okay, thank you very much.